to do. So let's start here with me and you. Gonna take a little time. Let's see what we can find. Oh, come on, walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on this, I'm going to say it, beautiful Saturday afternoon here on the Central Coast. And for anybody who is following any of the weather news, yes, there's some raindrops heading our way. Let's not freak out too much. I know that they're predicting a lot over the next 4, 5, 6 days, over the coming week, but I think we're going to do just fine. I think we'll be all right. And just, you know, batten down your hatches if you need to. Get out your floaties and your pontoons, and weather the storm. It'll be all right. I think it's going to be better. It's not going to be as bad as they're saying. But you know, you always prepare for the worst and hope for the best, as they say. And it's kind of the direction that our program is going to be going today. Not that it's going to be a bad program and I'm hoping for better. No. It's sort of the subject matter. If you've heard the promos over the last couple of days, we are going to be talking about grief. Yes, grief. And I scheduled this interview back in, I think, September or October. I had no idea where we would be in January of 2010. But here we are, and we are facing a major calamity that happened down in Haiti, an earthquake. What's interesting is, 9 years ago, I interviewed Russell Freeman, who is one of our guests. He is the co-author, along with John James, of the Grief Recovery Handbook. And I interviewed Russell back in, I believe it was October of 2001. And I believe it was surrounding a book regarding children and grief. Russell and John, welcome to our program.
Hi. Nice to talk to you again, Richard.
Yes. And John, it's a pleasure to have you on the program for the first time.
Well, I appreciate it.
Now, we're going to do everything that we can to try to keep this upbeat. But how in the world do you keep a conversation about grief and grieving upbeat? Explain it to me, Lucy.
Go for it, John.
Well,
I mean, what's the upside to grief?
Well, actually, by definition, grief is conflicting feelings caused by the end of or the change in familiar patterns of behavior. So just like in Haiti today, there are people who are having positive feelings, thank goodness I'm alive, and at the same time having sad feelings, I cannot find my mother. So both feelings are happening at the same time, caused by the same event. And that's normal and natural, and it is the reaction that people have to the greater than 45 different losses that you can have in a lifetime.
Now, I like that definition. We're not talking about specifically grief in light of the loss of a loved one, although that is encompassed, but your definition of grief, give that to us one more time.
The conflicting feelings we experience following the end of or the change in familiar patterns of behavior.
So
graduation from high school is a grieving experience.
Was for me anyway.
Yep.
But that's another story.
If you catch what John said, positive events have feelings as well as negative ones.
That's right.
And then just to add to this, to give a whole other context that carries forward, when someone important to us dies or when we get a divorce, the relationship we had with that person goes under review. It's an automatic. You don't get a vote. Your brain will do it. Your heart will do it. Your head will do it. And in that review, it's going to go over a whole myriad of things within the relationship, some of which were funny, some were fun, some were sad, some were frustrating. So that range now gets doubled up because now we have everything that we remember about our relationship with that person, which includes, like I say, humorous things, stubborn things, silly things. So we get all feelings there, too, not just sad feelings that they're gone. We remember everything about them and our relationship to them.
Yeah. And sometimes when we go back to those times before the change, we reminisce. That's what we like to call it. We reminisce. And again, that can it can be cathartic, but there are times, and we're going to get into this as we continue our program, you can also get stuck in that. And we want to help people to keep moving forward, but also experience the grief that they're having over whatever changes in their familiar behavior happen. A reminder again that the book is entitled The Grief Recovery Handbook, and it happens to be the 20th anniversary expanded edition. Although it doesn't look quite like War and Peace, so it's a fairly easy read. It's the action program for moving beyond death, divorce, and other lessons, including losses, including health, career, as well as faith. And we'll talk about that as well, because my gosh, I'd have to say that if I were down in Haiti and I'd experienced this 7.0 earthquake, there are those who, you know, say that, well, faith comes pretty quick to people, you know, religion, you know, oh God, hey, help me, get me out of here. But on the other hand, there are those for whom they thought they were living a good life, they were doing all the right things, and then this thing comes along, and it's like their faith is shaken. We'll talk a little bit about that as we continue here and find out more about the founders, Russell Friedman and John James, who are the founders, the co-founders of the Grief Recovery Institute. And that'll continue here on Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay right where you are.
You have a message that others can benefit from. A meditation to share, a talk to give that you want heard by more than just those present. A workshop, seminar, presentation with speakers whose information, insight, and inspiration can help others to break through to their highest potential and purpose. Making a quality recording is the first step to making it available, and fast forward is the right direction. They'll bring the recording studio to you. Your message is important. It needs to be recorded by professionals who share your passion and want to provide quality recording to those who want and need to hear it. Call 805-708-9804 to take that first step. 805-708-9804. Call Fast Forward for all your recording needs on location and in studio. 805-708-9804.
Have you lost direction in life? Do you constantly worry or give to others but deny your own heart? Hi, I'm Candy Hoff, healing practitioner and angel intuitive counselor. I'll inspire and help you find your inner strength to regain clarity and balance in your life. Book your transformational session in downtown Santa Barbara by phoning 831-277-3716 or visit my website, angelhealinghouse.com.
In the AM 1290 News Center, I'm Richard Dugan with this El Nino 2010 advisory. The sandbag station at the Annex Yard at 401 East Yananali Street will be open until 5 p.m. today to help local residents prepare for the heavy rain that is forecast for the Santa Barbara area during the next week. You are required to fill your own sandbags and be sure to bring your own gloves. From the AM 1290 News Center, I'm Richard Dugan, inviting you to stay tuned to AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, for continuing El Nino 2010 weather coverage.
What's the most important factor in selecting a roofing contractor? What good is your bargain-priced roof when you discover that the contractor's no longer in business when you have a problem? Jack at Action Roofing has been serving Carpinteria to Santa Ynez for over 20 years, a statement very few can make. Experience means good advice on selecting the correct roofing material, appropriate ventilation control, optional skylights, and most importantly, professional installation. Guaranteed. From composition to slate or concrete tiles, Jack at Action Roofing will recommend the best roof that fits the style of your house, as well as the budget of your wallet. Let Action Roofing give you the peace of mind knowing you've properly covered the biggest investment you own. Action Roofing's gutter and downspout division will protect your eaves from dry rot and prevent water from pooling at your foundation. When was the last time you had a gutter and downspout tune-up? Take action. Call Action Roofing at 966-3696. 966-3696.
Yes, and I do know how you feel.
Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan with New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sometimes we get stuck in our emotions, especially when it comes to grief. We get stuck there because it's so sad, it's so heartbreaking at whatever the loss is or whatever the change that we've experienced. And I have to say that, yes, graduation for me was from high school. Grade school wasn't a big deal. I could hardly wait to get out of there. But high school was a fun time. And, of course, they always tell you, these are the best years of your life. Make the best of them. And when they were gone, there was no more summer vacation. I miss that. When was the last time either of you had a three-month summer vacation?
Hello. How about a three-day one?
I'm looking for 3 hours, okay?
That'll work.
Now, my guests today are John James and Russell Friedman, and they've combined 30 years. They have a combined 30 years of work helping over 1 million people recover from grief through their Los Angeles-based nonprofit Grief Recovery Institute. And they're experts on addressing any type of grief that you may have. And we encourage you to get in touch with them. Now, we do have a website. We'll give that to you in just a few moments. They have one book that we're talking about in particular that is now in its 20th edition. It's the 20th anniversary of the Grief Recovery Handbook, and it is the action program for moving beyond death, divorce, and other losses, including health, career, and faith. And I have to tell you that death, divorce, career would have a grave impact on my faith, I think. So I would have a double, triple, or quadruple whammy when it comes to grief, and a lot of people are facing that. But when the towers came down and the thousands of lives that were lost 9 years ago, or just a week or so ago with the earthquake in Haiti and the loss of life there, even those of us who weren't involved, who weren't there, who don't have relatives there, who don't know anybody, we have no connection other than the TV screen. Some of us even grieve. Oh. How does that happen when it isn't truly a real change in that behavior, the definition that you gave just a few moments ago?
Any loss that is shown on the television will remind you of the unresolved losses that you have experienced and therefore bring them back to the surface.
Also, you know, over the years after the major events like the tsunami, we wrote articles, and I just keep using the same tagline and rewriting the article, and the answer to your question is because we are the family of humankind. And as John just said, when something happens to other humans, it makes our brain go to, but what about me? What about my grandfather? What about my dog? What about my wife? What about my family?
Mm-hmm.
And it goes right in, and then your brain remembers every sad or painful event in your life, or those sad feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So we are universally affected by things that make the news, although we realize consciously that it's triggering. You're right, it isn't about the people we don't know, it's actually about the people we did or do know. But it's about our feelings of sadness, which is also what our humanity is about.
Okay, we're going to talk more about that. I wanted to address what you just said as far as the event and family and friends and what about me, what about my family. And we talk an awful lot about living in this moment, living right now in this instant of time. Isn't grieving living in the past in a form?
Well, you could say that, but the problem is that if there's someone important to you dies, what your brain wants to know is, gee, are there some things I wish had happened different, better, or more? Because it reviews that relationship looking for unfinished things. It will take you on that search. That's what grief recovery is about, is helping you actively go into that search so you can complete the things that are left unfinished by a death, a divorce, or any other loss.
Kind of like cleaning house.
Great thing to say.
Yeah. I mean, all of us, especially nowadays, thinking of, you know, the ecological movement and trying to live green and clean and all of those good things, and downsizing just for the sake of downsizing. It has nothing to do with the economy. Just, I've got too much stuff, or I've got that pile of papers. I really need to go through that one day and sift out what's important and get rid of what's not important. And so the grieving process is similar in that context.
Well,
yes.
Yeah, and
go ahead, John.
Let's cut to the kind of important issue here. where grieving people are concerned, lack of courage is not the problem.
Okay.
It is lack of knowledge. They don't know what to do when a grieving experience lands in their lap. I mean, if you stop and think about it, the most hidden issue in our society, the issue that is less studied, less discussed than any other, is grief. We can't even say the word.
Mm-hmm.
I had a woman call me on the phone Thursday, and she was in tears. She was heartbroken, and her daughter was about to go off to college, starting in the mid-semester thing, and she's calling me on the phone saying, "Oh, I have empty nest syndrome." I said, "Honey, you are not a bird. You are grieving." You see, now, for instance, many years ago when I went to high school, in order to graduate, you had to take a class in health and safety and first aid. So, you know, if somebody fell down and broke their arm, everyone had some rudimentary knowledge about what action to take.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no class offered on what to do when your heart is broken.
Yeah.
We want to ignore it. And so here you have people who, if they had the tools, which is what is laid out in the Grief Recovery Handbook, if they had the tools, they wouldn't carry forward the unfinished business and therefore would not be living in the past.
Interesting. I know that when we talk about death and dying, I don't use those terms. I use the word transition. I don't even use the word passing away, because I view death in particular as you're just changing vehicles. Just like how many cars have the two of you gone through in your lifetime up to this point? But yet you still get from point A to point B. Well, I view the body as that same type of vehicle getting me from point A to point B, and I'm just gonna get a new model. Well, see, I don't know what it's gonna look like.
Well, but our issue is that we do grief recovery assistance
mm-hmm.
to people on every continent. As a matter of fact, just last week we signed a deal where the People's Republic of China Medical Publishing House is going to translate the Grief Recovery Handbook. Now, while you as one individual are comfortable with and understand what you mean with the word transition,
mm-hmm.
the very next person sitting next to you may not.
Right.
And so what we have to do is we have to hit it right down the middle for everyone.
Right.
We have grief recovery outreach programs in every one of the 12 major religions on earth.
Now,
and they all believe different things. Trust me when I tell you that.
Right, right. Oh, absolutely. Now, I understand the translating of the books. That's an easy one for me. How do you converse, and maybe not you two directly, because I'd be hard-pressed to believe that you both are multilingual in the 100 or 150 different languages of the planet.
Well, one of the things that we do is we find individuals within the countries who are bilingual, and then we train them in English, and then they can go home and communicate in the native language, because feeling or emotion always communicates better in that language. We have an office here in Los Angeles, but we also have an office in Canada, and we have an office in Stockholm, Sweden, that handles all of Scandinavia and so forth. And all we need is some bilingual people to begin with.
Let me ask you, if you could, let's go into some of these steps. I mean, I'd like to get more into this whole aspect of, this wonderful global assistance for people who are grieving. And again, this grieving is not just the loss of a loved one or of a relationship. It's actually across the board. And so let's talk a little bit about the steps that we want to go through. Because I remember, Russell, when we first talked, you told me that there is no 10 steps to getting through grief.
No, I said there are no stages.
No stages.
And we still, in fact, most recently we've debunked that or refuted that. Probably be a more polite thing to say. The idea of stages attached to grief. The original stages idea that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote about applied to the dying process, what you or I might go through if we are told we have a terminal illness. Over the years, they somehow got applied incorrectly to the grief you might feel if someone important to you dies or if you get a divorce. And they don't fit there at all. They just don't fit. The things that we focus on are six myths rather than stages that almost all of us universally here in English-speaking America or and in most of the Western world, regardless of your native language. And the first of the major myths that limit people's ability to deal with grief. Now, let's say this. Grief is a normal and natural reaction to loss, but almost everything that you and I ever learned about dealing with grief was not normal, not natural, and not helpful. And the very first thing you learned as a little boy was, don't feel bad, here, have a cookie, you'll feel better, which is absurd. Can you imagine if your heart's broken, someone has made you sad, someone has just hurt you or just insulted you or taken away your baseball, and someone says, hey, don't feel bad, here, have a cookie, you'll feel better. Well, the cookie doesn't actually make you feel better. It makes you feel different, and yeah. It distracts you for a minute or two from your emotional pain about having been treated badly.
Mm.
It also teaches you a tremendously bad habit, which is to medicate your feelings with substances. Well, so we have, the figure was, a couple years ago, the figure was 400,000 obesity-related deaths a year in this country alone. They've modified it now to like 200,000, which is still a huge number. But and think about the abuse of drugs and alcohol as well as food, all of which is predicated on a 3 or 4-year-old being told by his or her own parents, don't feel bad, here, have a cookie, you'll feel better. And by the time a child in our society is 15 years old, he's had more than 23,000 inputs suggesting, A, that he not feel bad in the first place, and B, if he does, please do it alone, don't tell anybody about it.
Yeah, exactly.
and I don't want to gang up here, but the very first comment that Russell just said, which was, don't feel bad, means really bury your feelings.
Yeah.
Now, if you go to the preschool today and watch little children process feelings, they process whatever feeling they're having in the moment they have it.
Yes.
They are like little bellows, you know, they take it in, they push it out. They take it in, they push it out. That is normal behavior. But by age 10 or 15, we have somehow convinced people that they should become trash compactors and never take out the trash.
Yeah.
and trust us when we tell you there are enormous consequences.
Yes.
For doing those kind of abnormal behaviors.
Physical, mental, as well as emotional consequences.
Physical, mental, spiritual, yeah. The list goes on and on and on.
Now, what's interesting is that a lot of people don't seem to grasp the converse concept. When was the last time you told a friend that you were with, a relative, who was sitting there having the greatest time in the world laughing and just, hey, don't feel good.
Right, exactly.
Here's a cookie. Don't feel good.
Don't feel good.
You know, it's like, wait a minute. On the one hand, these emotions are okay, but these aren't. And again, we go back to the compactor thing. So it's like, you know, and yet, if you want to study this particular subject or that particular, hey, the sky's the limit as far as education, physical fitness, whatever you want to eat, drink. Mm. If you choose to smoke, that's your choice. If you want to travel, you can go to any place on the planet, you know, on and on. But when it comes to your emotions,
Well, yeah. Exactly right. And it's actually astonishing as we travel around the world and discover that those two first little pieces of misinformation that Russell talked about, which is bury your feelings and do it with some external substance, those pieces of information are being taught to children all over the world.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so your work is perpetuated, yeah. But are you seeing any even twinklings of inroads in that? Changing.
Well, yes, at some level, the word grief is now at least being used.
Okay.
After 9/11, about 10 or 11 days after the World Trade Center bombings, I forget what magazine, so I'm not going to name one, but a magazine, a big, huge national publication, came out with a 154-page new edition, special edition, about 9/11. I read that magazine from cover to cover, And I want to tell you that the word grief did not appear.
Wow.
Now, I could tell you the burning temperature of jet fuel. I could tell you the melting temperature of steel. I could tell you the weight of all these buildings coming down. And yet, 2,756 people died from 91 different countries. And the word grief was never there.
Mm.
Now, today, though, you can turn on the television and you will hear them say, oh, the people in Haiti are grieving and so forth. So at some level, we've made a large contribution into making this a more aware issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on a much smaller scale, we have trained in our grief recovery certification programs, we have trained thousands of people who then return to their local communities. And they can then operate grief recovery outreach programs, and we have helped several million people in the last 32 years. And while that sounds like a good number, when you start dividing it into, you know, the population just here in the United States, it's a struggle. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. You're listening to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, joined by Russell Friedman and John James, co-authors as well as co-founders of the Grief Recovery Institute. The Grief Recovery Handbook is the book I'm talking about. It's the 20th anniversary expanded edition. And there's also a children's version, if you will, Children Who Grieve, if I'm correct.
When Children Grieve.
When. I knew there was a W word in there somewhere. When Children Grieve. And again, we're talking about the action program regarding the Grief Recovery Handbook and the Institute, the action plan for moving beyond death, divorce, and other losses, including health, career, and faith. And health, you know, is always kind of there, but career has been rocking everybody across this country, but literally around the world, probably for the first time in, you know, some 60 or 70 years. If my math is right, and I'm not going to claim to be a mathematician, but the fact is that everybody is on edge, even if they have a job.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like, okay, I'm going to do some pre-grieving just in case, you know, kind
well,
of thing.
Yeah. And the other thing, if we want to label this correctly, what's been going on for the last couple of years, it's really loss of trust.
Yeah, oh, very, yeah.
And that is whether or not you still have your job or whether you lost your job or your 401k is cut in half or whatever it is. People have experienced loss of trust in government, loss of trust in financial institutions, loss of trust in employers, loss of trust in their union. And these all have consequence.
It's interesting, too, that after 9/11, in interviews and possibly when I spoke with you, Richard, I talked about how America had kind of had a loss of innocence because we had never had a major attack on our shores in that way.
Yes.
And that it was kind of like the end of Disneyland. But I'm 67 now, so I was 50-something when 9/11 happened, and I had never experienced anything like it personally, you know, although I wasn't in the building in New York.
Sure.
But the whole sense of feelings of safety and of trust of the world I lived in what evaporated that day. And what has happened financially over the last 2 years is a parallel evaporation of that sense of trust of finance.
Yeah.
And at my age, I'm right at that perfect age. John's much younger than me, but at a perfect age, a perfect age where the worry about my future that I thought was set based on my investments and that kind of thing. And so we've had a kind of a crashing of trust again at a totally different kind of level.
Well, I can certainly attest to that as well. And it's funny, too, because I remember hearing, and this was sort of a sidebar thing, I remember hearing people talking about, you know, it's parallel to Pearl Harbor. And of course, I'm sitting here going, well, yeah, except for the fact that Pearl Harbor was not part of Hawaii at that time was not a part of the United States. It was a territory, granted.
Yeah, it was remote.
Yeah, but then I moved here to the Central Coast, and I found out that this is the only place on the continental United States where the Japanese actually did set foot here.
Yeah.
Along the Central Coast. Now, some weird stuff happened. I've heard some of the stories, and they turned around and left. It was just kind of bizarre and eerie. But nonetheless, there you go. So we have these events that happen, whether they're monumental and catastrophic, whether it's the trade centers, or whether it's in Spain with the trains, or England, and they had some problems
with the Channel Train,
with or whether it's hurricanes, earthquakes,
or the
volcanoes.
Tsunami, which was probably the biggest loss of life in my lifetime that I know of, a singular event.
And that was the day after Christmas, I want to say 2000, I think 7 or 8.
Hey, Richard, let me jump here and offer something quickly for the listening audience, a skill idea.
Okay.
When I was with you and the other programs I was on after 9/11, or after Andrea Yates drowned her children in Houston, and even now with the hurricane, the earthquake in Haiti, the children from maybe age 3 or 4 on up are exposed to the television no matter how parents try to protect them, and they see all these images. And we're talking about the imagery before, and it's powerful, life-altering stuff to look at. The thing that we want to address, the parents are saying, please don't tell your children, don't feel sad or don't feel scared, because the truth is, when you looked at those images, and anyone listening to us, when they looked at those images, they were sad and they were scared. And if they live in California, they may even be more scared, because we're having our own little eruption of earthquakes going on around us today.
Yes, that's right.
And so to tell someone not to be scared when they look at something scary, to tell someone, especially a child, not to feel sad when they see sad things with people dying, is the worst thing you can do. Now, you can't promise them that nothing bad will ever happen, but you can talk more openly and honestly. As the parent, you can say, wow, yes, honey, I was really scared, too, when I saw what happened. And yes, it reminds us that we have to take care of our safety and precautions, because, you know, for anything that might happen to us. And it reminds us to always tell the truth how sad we were to see those families. And it becomes a thing that inadvertently gives us a positive opportunity to give a lesson to our children about telling the truth about their feelings. And now we're back to the thing that you first brought up and that John gave that great definition of, is that this way we can say something in the moment in real time and not force our children to lie about how they feel. It promotes the truth in a very connective way to other humans, with the adults going first. Instead of trying to get the kid to go first, the adult goes first and the child will copy.
Well, now people can go to grief.net and learn more about the Grief Recovery Institute, as well as find out about the books that you folks have available. Not only do you have the 20th edition of the Grief Recovery Handbook, you also have Moving On in paperback, but you also, of course, have When Children Grieve, all available at grief.net. Grief.net. We're also linked to you at richarddugan.com. So go to the website, find out more, help yourself. You know, the thought that keeps coming back to mind is that the Grief Recovery Institute is not just a bunch of people who go out there and hold the hand of the person who's grieving and say, it'll be okay. It's all right. And you're not saying don't feel it. You're just saying, it's going to be all right. Just hang in there. You guys are doing more than just that.
Well, sure. And when we talk to a griever, when they tell us what's going on, we don't say it's good. We say, oh, my gosh, you must be devastated. Your world sounds upside down. So we hear the feeling that they're telling us rather than telling them not to feel. Remember, our first myth was don't feel bad. We never, ever tell someone not to feel bad. We say, oh, my gosh, how devastating for you. And then they know someone finally is listening to them. Love talking to us, even though we're strangers to them when they call here, because we're the first person who didn't tell them something stupid like, don't feel bad, tomorrow's another day.
Right, John.
Well, today's the day that their heart is broken. Tomorrow, they didn't even know about tomorrow.
Right, exactly. John, go ahead.
Well, what we really do in the initial contact is we help them to understand or to normalize the experience they're having, because it is normal.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we've grown up in a society that has tried to teach us that that which is normal and natural is somehow abnormal and unnatural.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then at that point, by the way, if people go to the website grief.net, up at the top there's a little button up there that says helpful articles. And we keep about 60 articles up there on every kind of loss that you can think about. And we rotate them every 60 days or so, and those are absolutely free. People can download them, they can print them up, they can read them, they can do whatever, because we really perceive our job as education. and that is giving people the information that they need to have in order to take the actions necessary to heal or complete a relationship that has ended or changed. As Russell has mentioned a couple of times, following a loss, the very first thing that happens is this overwhelming feeling of numbness. And then after that lifts, the people, their mind is going to go on this review of the entire relationship. And that's where they're going to first start to identify the things they wish had ended differently or things they wish they had done better and things like that. And those are the places that people have to devote some time to identifying that which is unfinished. And all of this is laid out in the Grief Recovery Handbook. And as you mentioned, it's a very easy read. And it's just kind of like follow along and do this and then do that and so forth. People call us and then we look them up. We look up their zip code or whatever, and we try to match them up with some of the people that we've trained over the years. And so there is help out there, is what I'm really trying to say.
Absolutely. At grief.net, that's the best first place to start, I would say, and find out more with Russell Friedman and John James. Now, a couple of very quick examples. I tried to do my utmost to make a couple of observations during some particular events in my life. One in particular was the observation of a dog, a Siberian Husky, who was a member of a four-pack. He was a sled team dog. He and his mother, his father, and his sister pulled sleds. And this was more for recreation than racing. Anyway, the mother and the father and the daughter, all three of them had to be put down. And they were put down one each year for three consecutive years. When the daughter, the last one to be taken away, was taken away, he went nuts. He was just beside himself, howling and carrying on and all of this. And so what I did was I said, I know he's missing her, but he's also missing the pack. And it goes back to the definition that you folks gave.
Yes.
So what I said was, okay, I can't stop him from grieving. There's nothing I can do, but what we can do is sort of distract him. So we took him out of that environment for the day, took him to get his hair, his fur groomed and those kinds of things. Just sort of that distraction temporarily.
Right.
Now, when we brought him to Santa Barbara and it was his time to go, we didn't take him to the vet. We let him go naturally in the presence of both my dog and my wife's dog.
Yep.
And he lay there maybe for an hour or two, gone. And the two of them would circle around the doghouse. I had a little porch where he was lying. And they were a part of that experience.
Yes.
So that when I took his body away, it wasn't the trauma.
Yes.
A big difference. And yet we tend to do that as humans with someone. We put them, like, they go to the hospital. Away from family, and yeah, okay, they need the medical care, we understand that, but there's that disconnect, that immediate ripping, that separation, that almost, it's, again, you're already starting to change the behavior patterns of the other people by the missing person.
Yeah, and this also has a history. It was very common, you remember back when women used to go to the hospital to have a baby, and they would be there for 3 or 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
And if it happened to be a stillborn, by the time the woman got out of the hospital and got back home, the baby room had been repainted, all the baby furniture had been taken away, and so forth, and it was as if nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, today we don't do that, thank God. But back then we used to, and I still have older women who come to seminars who are still grieving over the loss of a child, and it might have been 60 years ago.
Mm, wow. Well, and I have to say that there are times when I think of my paternal big brother,
Okay.
He lived across the street from us, and we met him and became friends, and of course the relationships grew. Then he lost the lease, and we said, well, why don't you move in with us for a couple of months until you can find a place, which he did, and in that time, he passed away in our home.
Mm-hmm.
But he was like a brother to me. I mean, and I can't say he was the brother I always wanted, because I actually have a brother, and I love him very much, too. But this was a gentleman who was teaching me things about cars and about mechanics and things of this nature, and we really got along well. And every once in a while, when the passing date comes, or his birthday comes, or we think about what we were going to do literally months before, you know, months after his
right.
passing. Yeah, it's like, it's not quite as intense. I don't necessarily, you know, well up with tears that time. But there was one thing I noticed, and this goes back to that observational thing. A few days after his passing, my wife and I were lying in bed just exhausted. And I started crying, and I started to get angry, and it was like I was the observer as well as the angry man. Madder than all get out that he had died, as if it was his fault.
Mm-hmm.
Where's all of this? This is all still, again, part of the fact that the whole behavior pattern in our lives has been rocked, shaken to the core.
Well, and also a piece of language we use, which is that unresolved grief is cumulative and cumulatively negative, and because time can't heal an emotional wound, when a current loss happens, it evokes, as we were saying before, all your old stuff can come back up, so you can have a mountain of emotions about something. Even as you say, the relationship was good, but it wasn't as huge as some other relationships, yet it brings back everything of yours.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that cumulative nature. And again, if we've been taught not to feel bad and to be strong instead of being human, and that we're taught that time heals, which it can't, then we tend to bury all those feelings. And then when a new loss happens, it just brings all, it's like an avalanche of everything that went before.
Wow.
Well, every time you make an observation, I think to myself, oh, I wish this interview were 4 hours, because you bring up 3-4 different things in every observation you make, like your one brother and then your kind of pseudo-brother.
Mm-hmm.
Every relationship is unique.
Yeah.
No two are the same, which is exactly why there are no such thing as stages of grief and, you know, that kind of foolishness. Absolutely, every relationship is unique, and they each have to be completed in a unique way. And that's enormously, enormously important for people to hear.
I want to jump in here before we go to our next break, and I have a question that I'd like to both of you to answer in the next couple of moments. The Grief Recovery Institute, how, and it's multifaceted, so it's almost I'm asking a little bit of a bio information. But why did you start this? When? I mean, what was the catalyst? I mean, that said, hey, let's go into the grief business.
I have yet to meet anyone who did it that way. I had a son die in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And I think prior to that time, I had always assumed that there were people who were trained to know how to help grievers. And then I began to look for these people, and I made a terrible discovery, and that is they didn't exist.
Uh-oh.
And so by trial and error or divine intervention, I'm not sure which, I kind of discovered a way to make myself feel better, and then I didn't do anything with it. And over the next several years, it got to the point where almost 60% of my day was spent talking to people that other people were sending to me who had experienced a loss.
Mm.
And that's when we started I started the Grief Recovery Institute. And then about, 21 or 22 years ago, Russell, who we lovingly refer to as the volunteer who will not go away, Russell showed up, and he was here for about a year. And so then we just made a little deal, and I gave him half of the institute. And so we've been hammering along here now, combined together for over 50-some years of experience.
And part of what's interesting, too, is that although John's, you know, the foundational event that caused him to create this was the death of the baby, I got here not at all related to a death, but on the heels of my second divorce and a bankruptcy for $500,000, the combination of which brought me to my knees. I mean, I was devastated beyond words. And people, you know, almost always want to associate the word grief only with death. Now, one of the things I think John and I have done successfully together with our institute is to expand the reach of the word grief so that it's all loss events, but all events that are chronicling that represent change in your life. The biggest invisible grief is winning. Do you know what, Richard, has happened to all the people who've won major lotteries around the world?
1 year later, they're exactly where they were, but when they started.
Except they need therapy they didn't need before. Well, they've lost all the money and all like that. So grief is about, as we said earlier, the change.
Yeah.
The change is what causes grief, not good or bad.
Right.
And we need to always define that so people will have an idea of solution. Go ahead, John.
Well, it isn't just the change. It's how well or how poorly they process the emotion caused by the change.
Mm.
And if they are like most people in our society who are taught to swallow half of their feelings, the sad half,
mm-hmm.
then there will be consequence. The divorce rate and the bankruptcy rate are two parallel, ever-rising lines. They are absolutely connected.
And I'm the proof positive of that.
Well, and that is simply because the character trait that is most common in grieving people is a reduced ability to concentrate.
Mm.
And so, now for most people, that means, following a loss, they're standing in the bedroom and they have a great idea, and 12 seconds later they're standing in the kitchen and they don't know why they went there. But imagine if this is a business person with that reduced ability to concentrate, who's trying to make business decisions.
Mm.
And there's so many things that in this little brief conversation we haven't covered. The next book that we're in the process of writing right now addresses the issue of pet loss, which by gross numbers is the largest loss in the United States.
I can imagine, because
14 million pet deaths a year in the United States.
Because pets don't live nearly as long as humans do.
No.
If you live to a natural
yes.
ending point.
Yeah.
Well, then I am going to offer this opportunity to the two of you, if you two are willing to do so. And it's completely up to you. We can continue this conversation following this program. We call it the after interview. Now, we don't do it with every guest because sometimes we kind of feel like, you know, we really hit it hard and good and fast and firm. And you know what? If we continued on, it would be wonderful. But let's go ahead and end it here at the top of the hour.
All right.
But if the two of you would like, what we will do as soon as the program is over here, we'll continue our conversation and the listeners will be able to hear that conversation when they click on the archive for this show once it's uploaded a little later on in the program.
Yeah, perfect.
So if we're in agreement, then what we'll do, folks, if you want to hear the rest of our conversation following the end of the broadcast, where I end the program by saying thank you for joining us, we're going to continue talking after that, and you'll have to go to the website, richarddugan.com, to listen to it. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Remember the stories your family used to tell?
Till I got married, 1913, when my father and my uncle came from Italy.
When was the last time you listened to the songs of your youth?
Well, close.
Yes, very swinging sound here in the Bilhart Underground. That's Wild Things.
Want to hear those voices and music again? Fast Forward can help. Fast Forward Audio Communications can transfer your records and tapes to CD so you can hear them again for the first time.
You're listening to a live transmission of the voice of astronaut Walter Chirac.
Those memories are priceless and are great to hand down to the next generation. Keep those memories alive. Call 805-708-9804.
That's the freshest thing that I ever heard.
Fast Forward. It's the right direction for preserving your family memories. Just call 805-708-9804.
Are you sad or angry about past events in your life? Would you like more joy, love, and peace? Hi, I'm Candy Hoff, healing practitioner and angel intuitive counselor. I'll inspire and help you find your inner strength to regain clarity and balance in your life. Book your transformational session in downtown Santa Barbara by phoning 831-277-3716 or visit my website, angelhealinghouse.com.
In the AM 1290 News Center, I'm Richard Dugan with this El Nino 2010 advisory. The sandbag station at the Annex Yard at 401 East Yananali Street will be open until 5 p.m. today to help local residents prepare for the heavy rain that is forecast for the Santa Barbara area during the next week. You are required to fill your own sandbags and be sure to bring your own gloves. From the AM 1290 News Center, I'm Richard Dugan, inviting you to stay tuned to AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, for continuing El Nino 2010 weather coverage.
If we leave here today, we could be 1,000 miles away. Take to that road, see how far it goes, and on that great ocean road, all the trouble that you know empties out as you go. Walk with me, tell me your stories.
New paradigms for a new world, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And I'm hoping that we have been able to help some of you to take a better look at and a clearer look at what's troubling you, the grief that you're going through, the loss of whatever it might be. And I can certainly attest, John and Russell, to the whole loss of a pet, because we just recently lost one of our cats, and it was an experience that we held dear and close to us even at the moment of death. And it was extraordinary, but you know, that little one isn't there anymore. And I can honestly say that there has been a time since his passing I've actually seen him in the house.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a big deal. And we're going to continue this conversation. Now, normally, about this point, John and Russell, I usually ask my final question. I'm going to save that for the front end of our after view, our after interview, if you will, so that we can sort of wrap things up here on the air and then continue on. We have just a couple of minutes, and I want to thank the two of you for joining me and for agreeing to stay with us for a few minutes after the broadcast. So if you'd like to hear the rest of the story, if you will, if I may borrow that phrase, you can go to richarddugan.com, go to the radio show's page, and click on the play button next to Russell and John's names, and you will also be able to click on their names and go to their website, grief.net, to get more information. Do you have a title for the new book?
Not yet, but... Okay. That usually presents itself out of the writing.
Okay. Well, I'm very interested in reading that, and we will certainly look forward to having you back on when that book comes out.
Absolutely. By the way, I just want to make one comment. Our book is for sale, obviously, through our website and Amazon and your local bookstore. But over the years, John and I have donated thousands of copies of our books to libraries all around the country. So anyone listening to us who doesn't have money or is fearful about money, please go to the library, get the book. That's the content of the book, not money, that's at stake here. So go get what it has to offer. And like John said, all the articles we've written are available on that website for no fee. You can download them, you can read them, you can print them, you can send them to friends. But get the information. It's way better to know what to do than to be in the dark when you are, you know, broadsided by emotional events.
Yeah, it's funny because I remember a phrase that was used quite regularly to me in a job that I had back in the mid-70s. The phrase was that information is power.
Absolutely.
And it's still true today as it was back then, and if not before then.
And in this case, accurate information on this topic is not available a lot. There's so much misinformation. And as John said, we're educators. Our job is to re-educate folks.
Well, again, I want to thank the two of you for joining us. We're going to continue our conversation after the broadcast is over. Go to richarddugan.com, and you will be able to tune into that. And, of course, John and Russell, stay right where you are. We're going to continue talking until next Saturday at this same time. Tell me your story, 3 p.m. Pacific time, and on the web, streaming live at richarddugan.com. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, saying love to all, and have a great day. And as we continue talking here on the program Tell Me Your Story with Russell Friedman and John James, who are co-authors of the book, The Grief Recovery Handbook. It's the 20th anniversary expanded edition, as well as When Children Grieve and Moving On, as well as a new book that you two have coming out in the not too distant future, we hope, about grieving the loss of a pet.
Well, one of the things I've never been able to get past is the writer's reality, which is the third draft is the first draft.
I'll keep that in mind as I'm writing my book.
Oh, you have no idea.
I'll keep it short. I'll keep the book short so that I won't have to go through it quite as severely. Well, let me pose a couple of quick questions to the two of you. Actually, they're not quick questions. Russell, you made a comment about, you know, humanity and how, you know, your book is translated into multiple languages. And of course, you have teams around the country and not, if not around the world, that are able to be there to be the support system, if you will, for people who are in need. And it sounds to me like you guys answer your own phones, too, especially, you know, with conversations that you have with different folks. And one of the questions has to do with where we're going as a species, as the human, the race of humans. And the question is rather large, and you can give me whatever answer you like, but I'm just curious as to where do we want to be in 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 years as the race of man? Because it doesn't seem like we're getting anywhere.
Go ahead, John. Go first.
Well, the first thing, it's interesting. Science makes discoveries. The information gets disseminated, and then there's a 2 or 3 generation drag time before it becomes common knowledge or commonly accepted. And about, 15 years ago, I think the first time the National Geographic study was published, which proves absolutely through mitochondrial DNA that we all are related. We all can track back our life 200,000 years to the first female hominid, and that is through mitochondrial DNA. So when we say, we're connected, that's a piece of truth. That is a reality of the world we're living in. Now, the problem is that 99.9% of the population of the Earth hasn't found that out yet. Okay? And where we'll be 100 years from now, I read an article recently where by somewhere around the year 2060, there will be no such thing as race anymore because of intermarriage and,
right,
and so on and so forth. And quite frankly, I think all of those things are really good things.
Okay.
Now, let me jump in and tie this to a different aspect of what we do. John and I, what our primary function is at one level, we would say to move people about 14 inches from their head to their heart. Grief is about emotion. It's about a broken heart, not a broken head. Now, technology, which is a fascinating thing, and as John knows, I'm kind of, you know, a couple of centuries behind on technology. John's way ahead of me on that. But technology doesn't fix feelings. That's the gap here. In fact, John and I individually both saw that new movie, that George Clooney movie, Up in the Air.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about it the other day. One of the things that happened, one of the little female leads in it is like this little automaton machine firing people. That's her job to do, and she's like a little mechanic at that. And then when she has a romantic breakdown, she dissolves into tears, as normal people do. So with all the technology of her intellect and what she could do, when it came to feelings, we're back to square one. I, for one, don't think that's going to change in 20 years, nor should it. And that's why John and I have to dedicate as much whatever time we have left on this planet to keeping re-educating people that how to deal effectively with feelings is always going to be relevant regardless of technology.
Okay. And I appreciate that. And I will ask the question that I normally save for the end of the broadcast. And it has to do with the two of you. And granted that between the two of you, you have, you know, several decades of experience in this field, and you've continued your research and obviously writing a new book. But the two of you could be doing a lot of other things right now. I mean,
like playing golf on a beautiful day.
Well, there's an idea too, but of course, from a business standpoint, I mean, you could be stockbrokers for all I know. We're working in a grocery
selling
store.
Selling widgets.
Or selling widgets, but you're not. You are. You are peddling. You're not peddling grief, but you're helping people to peddle through grief. Why this? Why now?
Satisfaction.
Satisfaction from John and Russell?
Frankly, I need to give back the gift I got. It is the most compelling thing for me. So satisfaction works, but it propels me every day.
Mm.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing to watch people come into contact with us that, if I had to pick a color to describe them, I would say they're gray. And when you give them a little bit of information and then create an emotionally safe environment for them to road test the new information, to watch the transformation in people is astonishing. And that's why I have often thought to myself, if we could just get the information we have, if we could just get this taught in like grade 6 all over the world, within a very short period of time, we could make a huge turnaround in the way that we deal with emotion in the world. But that's not going to happen in my lifetime, so...
Yeah.
I'm now busy looking for our successor.
Yeah, well, that's a wise thing, and I would say, yeah, that is kind of a frustration because I don't think that gun safety is necessarily an appropriate thing to be teaching in school per se. It's important to know to be safe around guns and what to do or not to do. I don't know that learning how to put a condom on a banana is necessarily part of the curriculum. I don't see where that's going to help you per se in the big picture. But dealing with your grief, dealing with what you're going through that could hinder you from going out and doing the things that you want to do, fulfilling the dreams that you have, and even contemplating the dreams.
Yes. And you got to realize here, next to breathing, experiencing loss is absolutely the most next predictable thing in a person's life. I mean, we keep teaching people, you know, how to acquire things, but we don't teach them a single thing about what to do when they lose things.
Yeah.
And loss, trust me, is far more certain than gain. And we see it all the time. All the college kids who worked hard and studied hard and stayed on and got their master's degree, and they were going to come out and get a job and pay off their student loan. And I'm 65 years old, and I've never seen it this bad. And so they come out of school, and there is no job. And so now we have loss of hopes and loss of dreams and loss of expectation. And if people bottle that stuff up, it will negatively affect their life forever.
Wow. Now, something just flashed into my mind. You're talking about loss. How does one address the gradual loss of their faculties? Someone who is in the early stages of dementia or Alzheimer, they're still conscious, but it's like they're starting to notice the telltale signs. And it's like, oh my God, my ability to be here in not only just this moment, but in this world, consciously, cognitively, maybe that's the better word.
Yep.
I'm going to lose that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's really interesting because that it's not that that's an ever-increasing experience. It is that we have an ever-increasing aging of the society.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is happening more often just, you know, based on the age of the baby boomers and so forth. And that is an awful, awful, terrible moment for the adult who experiences that. But also, just like the pebble in the pond, it is an awful, awful experience for the adult children.
Yeah.
That is, by the way, the fastest growing loss experience in the world today.
And we need to add to this, there are 6 myths that we disseminate in our books and our lectures. We've only really talked about one of them today, don't feel bad. We touched on not grieving alone. We touched on a few things. But the 6 myths, including the myth that time heals all wounds, all of these are really important so that when that thing happens you described, Richard, where someone starts to get an inkling that they're starting to slip in their mental faculty or their memory and things like that, which is also parallel to when their physical health, I'm at an age where my health is shifting, mm-hmm. you know, and the awareness of that. Well, if you have a foundation of effective ideas for dealing with loss, including those kinds of losses, then you're in better circumstance than if you don't, because in a crisis, you will use old ideas or old beliefs. If your old ideas are incorrect, you will apply them and they won't help you. So as you diminish at some point, let's face it, we're all going to physically diminish if we live long enough. We're going to emotionally or, you know, mechanically, we'll, our minds will diminish in spite of, you know, doing crossword puzzles and things like that. But if you have a good foundation for dealing with your feelings, as it happens, you will deal more effectively with it. You will less negatively affect the people around you because you'll be able to communicate more clearly as long as you have that faculty. So the key is learning better ways to talk about your feelings, because you can't avoid some of the other things that are going
to
happen.
Yeah, and it's almost impossible to pick one issue like dementia, Alzheimer's, and so forth. Because grief covers, you know, like the whole age range. We're raised in a society where we're taught to identify the problem and solve the problem. And we develop a whole track record of identify the problem, solve the problem, and so forth. Well, then along comes the day when we realize our mental faculties are slipping, and so we've identified the problem.
Mm-hmm.
No solution.
Yeah.
Or we're a wonderful young married couple, and we have a little beautiful, wonderful baby, and everything's great, and about 2.5, things change, and all of a sudden we go get the autism diagnosis, and we can identify the problem, but guess what? No solution. Do you see? And all of that creates this myriad of feelings that we have been trained to somehow swallow and not talk about. And it's just heartbreaking
yeah.
to watch that.
Well, let's quickly here, in the short time that we have, because the two of you I know need to get moving on too, let's go over those six myths that we've all, at one time or another, have bought into, one or all of them, regarding grieving.
Well, the first one is, of course, bury sadness, okay? And then the next one is that you replace the loss.
So in my case, I should get another cat.
Yeah, well, let's...
Or put, not.
Not yet. We'll never be able to get through the six, though, because here's the problem. You can't say hello to the new until you have said goodbye to the old.
Uh-huh.
But if you don't know how to say goodbye to the old, do you follow what I'm
yes,
saying?
Yes, I do.
That's
yes.
why 66% of people who experience the death of a pet never replace the pet.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
The other one of those myths is to grieve alone. Now, we don't ever say, you know, no one would ever be so insensitive as to say to someone, listen, you're grieving, so you have to grieve alone. But what we do is we talk about the griever. Two other people talk about the griever, and they'll say things like, well, we have to give her space, which means isolate them.
And also, we are taught from an early age. Let me say a sentence, Richard, and I want you to put in the last word. And I want the audience listening to put in the last word, okay? Laugh and the whole world laughs with you. Cry and you cry
alone.
So you were brainwashed with everyone else to isolate yourself when you feel sad or mad. If you're going to cry, go to your room. Knock off that crying or I'll give you a reason to cry. So we're socialized incorrectly to isolate ourselves and, as John said, isolate others by saying, oh, leave her alone. She needs her space.
Well, I had that very experience as a child when my dear grandmother on my mother's side passed away. And we were in the church for the funeral, and I was carrying on about how sad I was about the loss of Grandma and how much I was going to miss, how much I missed her, and so on and so forth. And my mother nearly had me taken out of the church.
Wow.
Nearly taken out of the church.
You know, and that's one that is enormously interesting, because the shortest scripture in the Christian Bible is Jesus wept.
Mm-hmm.
And he wept following the death of his friend.
Yeah.
And yet somehow what was perfectly okay 2,000 years ago has become a negative.
Yeah.
then, well, the fourth thing is that, which Russell has talked about several times, is this concept that time heals all wounds or grief just takes time, and that is preposterous. But the one I'm born and raised in the Midwest, and when I grew up, two of the things that they used to say all the time were, you have to be strong for someone else, and you have to keep busy.
Yeah, yeah.
And these were all solutions that I was presented with as how you deal with grief when I was a kid growing up.
You know, it's interesting, those six myths, don't feel bad, replace the loss, grieve alone, just takes time, be strong or be strong for others and keep busy. You know, here in the English-speaking Western world, and you, we're all three of us Americans, we all can relate to them. I believe you relate to all of them, Richard.
Yes.
You, somewhere along the line, you learned them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And nowhere along the line, until people talk to us, does anyone ever contest them and say, well, let's look at that. Time can't heal an emotional wound any more than time could put air back in a flat tire. But one of the things that has staggered me, We have had people come here from everywhere in the known universe on this planet, people whose original language and original culture, original religion, things that you only read about in books. And to this point, I can sit here on the phone and tell you that I have yet to meet someone who couldn't relate to most or all of those things, no matter where they came from. I have yet to find a cultural backdrop for anyone that's any different than the one we got, no matter what their original language was. And I am staggered by that. And the only good news is that it allows us to help them and then teach them how to help others, because we realize there's a universal problem, and at least we have a solution when the problem sets up the same in terms of bad knowledge.
Now, the other downside, of course, is that there is no civilization on the planet that has done it the right way for you to model. That's
not lately.
So you've created your own model
at some point, but not lately.
Now, see,
that actually is pretty good for us, because we operate here based on a principle, and the principle is delivering grief recovery assistance to the largest number of people in the shortest period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So while there may be wars going on in the Middle East, for instance, we have grief recovery outreach programs in the Palestinian refugee camps. We have grief recovery outreach programs in Israel. We have grief recovery outreach programs in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if there are grievers and somebody is interested in helping grievers, I don't care where they are, we will make it happen.
Wow.
One way or another, it's going to happen. It's like, you know, we'll get the call once a year from the pro-life people, and they want us to be on the board of on their letterhead or something, and we say no. And then 2 minutes later, we get a call from the pro-choice people, and we say no. And they both say why. And we say, we're for grievers. And we can find them in both places.
Yes,
exactly. We don't have any problem here finding grievers. And that's what we're about. Singularly, almost to a distraction, we are really focused on the one thing that we do.
Yeah. Well, I am certainly glad that the both of you combined forces to bring about the Grief Recovery Institute, as well as the books that you have and are going to be bringing out to us. The Grief Recovery Handbook, the 20th Anniversary Expanded Edition, the Action Program for Moving Beyond Death, Divorce, and Other Losses, including Health, Career,
and wait
faith.
One second here. I'm not going to let you get away without saying this.
Okay.
I want to thank you personally for having the courage to have this topic on.
Well,
many people are not courageous enough to address this topic.
I have to say, first of all, thank you. And the other aspect of it is, when I first met Russell and I saw the book back in 2001, because I have been doing series over the last 30 years on the subject of death and dying specifically, and again, I know that's just one area,
right.
That is one aspect of the process that that we have to deal with, that we deal with in the interview, is the grieving of the loss of this person. And so for me, to have the two of you on now, as well as Russell back 9 years ago, it only makes sense. It fits. It's a part of what we need to deal with. And with this radio program we're doing here, Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, in order for us, and again, we talked before about the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual ramifications of stuffing, of becoming the compactor.
Right.
If we don't start expanding and and stop the compactor function and expand it and get it out and get rid of it, then we will never evolve forward as an individual.
Couldn't agree more.
Or as a civilization. And that's where that question that I asked you at the front end of the after interview comes from, because I'm saddened in one sense, I mean, there was where the grief comes from, that we're not achieving something as a species. The last time that we did it was in the 1960s, when at least the American continent and its people gathered, and then of course people around the world began to join in the space program and putting a man on the moon. That was the last time that we have ever collectively decided we're going to do something in the affirmative to create rather than to destroy.
I was talking to somebody just the other day about the last thing I saw, the space program, but just before that was when we finally got tired of polio. And I remember Eisenhower going on television. Of course, there were only about 8 TVs in the country then. But it was, okay, enough of this polio. And within 36 months, bingo, talk vaccine, boom, polio, gone. And if somehow we're so busy being different, we have forgotten that we are the same.
Exactly.
Well, God bless you.
Well, thank you very much. And the same to the two of you. I want to thank you so much and your wives for sharing this extra
time. On a
Saturday
of all days.
Absolutely. And so I hope that you still have enough sunlight out there. Well, I guess not, because the clouds are rolling. I was going to say you could maybe knock out 9 holes before the sun goes down.
Go hit a bucket.
There you go.
All right. I hope your house stays on top of the hill, not at the bottom.
Well, if the very least, maybe we'll slide next to you in Sherman Oaks. I don't know. Gentlemen, thank you again for the time.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that'll wrap up this edition of Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing in the after interview with us. And I hope that you'll tune in regularly as we come your way at 3 p.m. every Saturday Pacific time. And we stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com. Until next Saturday at the same time, once again, love to all.